Morning, everyone. It's really great to be here with you, and I would just like to add a word of appreciation from Gloria and I, how faithful the church here has been for 15 long years to support us in York. We wouldn't be there without you, and I'm confident that through your prayers and through your support, you are laying up treasure in heaven, and you are affecting young lives in ways that one day you'll find out in glory, I'm sure. But we love what we're doing there. God continues to bless, and we hope to be there for 15 more, Lord willing. We'll see. Well, let me begin with a word of prayer, and then I'll introduce our message. Father, as we look at your word this morning, and really, Father, as we just focus in on that mighty act of the cross and resurrection, Lord, I pray that you'll pour out your spirit, that you'll speak to us, Lord, that you'll show us in even greater ways, Lord, just how marvelous you are, how powerful your truth is. And Lord, I just thank you for the resurrection life that lives in every believer. We pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen. So I hadn't talked with Matt or anyone on the worship team, but so many of the songs this morning really fit right in with this theme of cross and resurrection that I'd like to share with you today. I want to talk with you, excuse me, about some evidences for the cross and resurrection. Now you may say, oh, wait a minute, we've read Lee Strobel and Case for Christ, and you know, Josh McDowell had a great book many years ago, More Than a Carpenter. And I'm not going to share any of those. Those are wonderful evidences for the cross and resurrection. And some of you probably have read those books. If you haven't, I would encourage you to. They're wonderful books. But in my study over the last few years, I teach a class in New Testament backgrounds. One of the things that I've come across is some other evidences that have really just kind of blown me away. Because when you add together the things that Lee Strobel and Josh McDowell and other Christian apologists talk about when they talk about evidence for the resurrection, and when you add in some of this other material that other people are beginning to share, it's really overpowering just how much evidence there is for the reality of the cross and resurrection. So I'd like to share a little bit of that with you today. New Testament scholar Ben Witherington says, when you know the context of New Testament texts, the world and cultures in and to which these stories were written, you quickly realize that sometimes the unusual aspects in the stories testify to their historical veracity and authenticity. And that's what I want to talk with you about today. I want to share with you some cultural things that were part of the first century that you may or may not be aware of, and how that helps enlighten our understanding of the cross and resurrection. And I also want to share with you some interesting things in the New Testament that, as Ben Witherington says here, they're unusual aspects of the story, and not normally the way you would think someone who might want to begin a quote-unquote new religion, some of the stories that they would have told. First thing I want to share with you guys this morning is on the topic of honor and shame. Now, in 1 Corinthians chapter 1 and verse 18, the Apostle Paul tells us that he preaches Christ crucified, and that it is to the Jews a stumbling block and to Greeks foolishness. But to those of us who are being saved, it is the power of God. We need to take what Paul's saying there very seriously, that the cross of Christ was a stumbling block to Jews and that it was foolishness to Greeks. In the first century world, crucifixion meant shame. And it was not only an instrument of execution devised to bring the greatest torture possible, but it was devised to bring the greatest shame on a person that was possible. The writer of Hebrews addresses this in Hebrews chapter 12 and verse 2. He says, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the pioneer and perfecter of faith, for the joy set before him, he endured the cross, scorning its shame. In the first century world, the cross was looked on as a shameful instrument of death and torture. We've sort of lost that offense of the cross over 2,000 years because for Christians, it's come to mean a sign of victory, and rightly so. And we put it on our churches and we wear it around our necks. But as a result, we perhaps have become a little tainted toward the offense of the cross. In the first century, the cross was a great offense. Not only did you not want to die on a cross, you didn't want to be associated with anyone who had died on a cross. You would want to distance yourself from anyone who had experienced crucifixion. Now, a lot of the reason for this has to do with the honor-shame culture of the first century. The first century Roman world was a culture built on the values of honor and shame. That is, individuals pursued honor. They wanted to be seen as honorable people. They wanted to be part of an honorable family, part of an honorable city or an honorable culture. And they wanted to avoid shame at all costs. Shame was literally a life and death matter, because if you were shamed, you would be ostracized. You could be ostracized from your family. You could be ostracized from your town. And then the kind of life you would have to leave would be like some sort of outlaw or someone just trying to scrounge around to make ends meet any way that you could. But no one would want to have anything to do with you. And in the ancient world, you needed those connections. You couldn't live on your own. You needed the resources that came with living in a society like that. Even today, we can relate to this concept of honor and shame. We see it, for instance, in the Far East today when people talk about saving face or losing face. And perhaps you've heard some of the stories of executives over in Japan or somewhere like that who had a very honorable position, but then something went wrong in the company and they lost face. It's a very serious matter because what it does is it destroys their careers. They are no longer looked on the same way, and they have a very hard time, you know, having a normal life after that. In the Middle East today, in Islamic cultures, we sometimes hear about honor killings. They take honor so seriously that if a member of their family does something that would bring shame on the family, the only way they believe they can remove that shame is to kill that individual. And so they call it honor killings. So this is a part of first century culture, this idea of honor and shame, and it's very, very important. So think about the cross against this background, the cross being an instrument of shame. And so the last thing you want to do is either be crucified or be associated with someone who is. Bible scholar David De Silva writes the following about honor and shame. He says, a person born into first century Mediterranean culture was led from childhood to seek honor and to avoid disgrace. Honor comes from the affirmation of a person's worth by peers and society, awarded on the basis of the individual's ability to embody the virtues and attributes his or her society values. So, again, honor was the key thing in the Mediterranean culture of the first century that you needed to have. It would almost be today like if you tried to live your life without your credit card. That's sort of a frivolous example, but we can all relate to the fact that credit cards provide identity, they provide the opportunity to purchase things and that kind of thing. Without honor in the ancient world, basically you've lost your identity and you've lost your ability to interrelate with other people in that culture. So it's very significant. Some of the ancient critics of the early church, a guy by the name of Celsus, who lived in 177 AD, who was a great skeptic and very scornful about Christianity, he said, but if Jesus was really so great, he ought, in order to display his divinity, to have disappeared suddenly from the cross. And so the fact that he couldn't extricate himself from the cross and that he died on the cross, in Celsus's view, was evidence that he really wasn't who he claimed to be. Justin Martyr, who was one of the earliest apologists for the church, he lived in the second century, he wrote, "They say that our madness consists in this fact, that we put a crucified man in second place after the unchangeable and eternal God, the creator of the world." So Justin Martyr is saying, you know, people in my world, they look at us Christians and they say they're mad, out of their minds. Last week, Pastor Sandy put up this drawing, and I wanted to share it with you again. This drawing comes from the 2nd or 3rd century A.D., Roman graffiti. And as Sandy mentioned last week, what it says is that Alexamenus worships his God. And you have this figure, part man on the cross, but with a donkey's head. This shows the scorn and the disbelief of the normal pagan world in the first century and on when it came to crucifixion. They thought this is just the most ridiculous idea in the world that anyone would worship someone who was crucified on a cross. The unlikelihood of Christianity being invented or surviving in this context has led one scholar to write a book that's entitled, "Why on Earth Did Anyone Become a Christian in the First 3 Centuries?" I mean, really, when you stop and think about it, this is the craziest way. If you're one of the disciples, and you're saying, you know what, okay, Jesus is gone, and we want to carry on his legacy, and so let's invent a new religion. How shall we start it? Oh, one of them pipes up, "I've got a great idea. Jesus was crucified, and so let's worship him as God and say that, you know, he rose from the dead." In that society, that would be the worst idea you could possibly have. If it hadn't really happened, people would have looked at that person and said, "Are you out of your mind? We're not going to run around proclaiming someone who was crucified on a cross. Do you know what that would do for us? We'd be laughing stocks, and more than that, if we associate with someone who's crucified and we try to glorify them, probably the same kind of thing is going to happen to us. We're going to be shamed, we're going to be excluded, we're going to be persecuted." It is not an idea that would have ever entered the mind of a first century person. There were a number of messiahs in the first century BC and first century AD and on into the second century, would-be messiahs in Judaism, who said they were the one that God had appointed, that God had chosen. Every one of them was killed and executed by the Romans. Not one of their followers ever said, "Oh, yeah, he really was the Messiah, and we believe it because, you know, he was crucified or he was executed by the Romans." No. When those rebellions were put down and those so-called messiahs were executed, that was the end of the movement. In fact, crucifixion ended every rebellion and movement of the ancient world. Think of Spartacus, who many of you have probably heard of, who led a slave rebellion in 70 BC. Had some success for a while, but eventually the Roman legions overwhelmed him and his slave army. Crucified 70,000 of them. Do you know that in the rest of Rome's history, there was never again a slave rebellion? Crucifixion ended every rebellion, every movement. Except one, right? Sandy was teaching last week on Romans chapter 1, verse 16, right? "For I'm not ashamed of the gospel of Christ." And he talked about how we as Christians should be proud of the cross. And we don't need to be ashamed. Why did Paul choose those words? Because in his society, it was natural for the ordinary person to be ashamed of the cross and ashamed of a gospel, a good news message that would say, "We believe in a crucified Messiah." But we rightly take pride in it today, but we do it because these early Christians not only asserted it was true, but by the power of God, they demonstrated that it was true. And Paul goes on to say, "For I'm not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God unto salvation." Why did Christianity succeed in these early centuries when it should have failed? The only explanation is the power of God was behind it. A second evidence for the cross and resurrection is the worship of Jesus as God. Now, this might strike you a little funny. It's because we're so used to worshiping Jesus as God. He was God. God in the flesh came down to us. But think how unusual this would be for the very first believers in Jesus. They were all Jewish, right? Jews don't worship any other God but the one true God. The Jews had learned that through the harsh exile that they had experienced in Babylon. And as the centuries rolled by the time we get to the first century, you could not get a Jew to bow a knee to any other God but the God of the Bible. Now, there were many great characters and figures throughout their history, people like Abraham, Moses, David, on we could go. The sect at Qumran that's famous for copying the Dead Sea Scrolls, they have a whole big literature around Melchizedek and what a glorious and amazing figure he was. They talk about angels, you know, Michael and Gabriel and so on. But no matter how revered any of these people were, none of them was ever worshipped by a Jew, because the Jew knew that they only bowed their knee to God. And if a Roman or anyone else would try to get them to bow their knee to an idol or to a man or to an angel, they would bare their necks and they would say, "Go ahead, put me to death, because I'm not going to worship anyone but God." And yet the incredible thing is that following the resurrection of Jesus, a group of Jews began worshiping Jesus as God. What explains that incredible transformation? How does a people who refuses to worship anybody but God all of a sudden begin worshiping Jesus as God? He must have been God. The resurrection demonstrated it. It proclaimed it. They saw him in the flesh after he had been raised from the dead. How could they not call him God? How could they not worship him as God? But it's an extraordinary fact that because we take for common that that Jesus was God, we often don't stop to think of how radical that was when Jews began worshiping Jesus as God in the first century. So, Bible scholar Larry Hurtado has written, "The time between the death of Jesus and the fully developed Christology, in other words, all the things that we know and can say about Jesus, which we find in the earliest Christian documents, the letters of Paul, the time is so short that the development which takes place within it can only be called amazing." There are a number of other Jewish sects in the first century. You know, some of them, Sadducees, Pharisees, Essenes. Those groups disagreed with one another, may not have liked one another, but they tolerated each other. But none of the Jews tolerated the sect known as the Nazarenes or the Christians, right? Why is that? Why would they tolerate one another but not tolerate the early believers in Jesus? The most obvious explanation is because the early believers in Jesus were worshiping him as God, and the other unbelieving Jews saw that as blasphemous. There's no other explanation for that incredible transformation other than it really happened. A third witness to the cross and resurrection is the idea of resurrection on the third day. And we know that Jesus talked about the fact that he would be crucified and that he would raise again on the third day. Let me invite you to turn over to Mark chapter 9, and I want us to read together verses 30 through 32. Mark 9, beginning with verse 30. "They left that place and passed through Galilee. Jesus did not want anyone to know where they were, because he was teaching his disciples. He said to them, 'The Son of Man is going to be delivered into the hands of men. They will kill him, and after 3 days, he will rise.' But they didn't understand what he meant and were afraid to ask him." Now, I used to puzzle over that statement. What was it they didn't understand about what Jesus said? Son of Man's going to be killed, and 3 days later, he's going to rise. What's so hard about that? What's so cryptic about that? Well, turns out that within Judaism, although many of the Jews believed in the physical bodily resurrection, they didn't believe that the resurrection would happen until the end of time. So we even have some Jews that didn't believe in a resurrection at all, like the Sadducees, right? But those Jews who did believe in a bodily resurrection all believed it would happen in the day of judgment, at the end of time. And so for Jesus to say, I'm going to be raised in 3 days, it just didn't make any sense to them. They didn't know how to interpret that or understand it because it wasn't a part of Jewish teaching. So that someone would rise in the middle of history never to die again, well, it was a totally new concept. And think about these early Christians. Again, if this is all made up, they're standing there and they're saying, well, let's see, we want to invent a new religion. How do we do it? How do we get people to follow us? Well, we'll start with a crucified Messiah. That'll surely hook everybody. And then they say, and let's go to our fellow Jews and let's tell them that Jesus is God and they should worship him. And then they come and they say, and let's make up kind of this new doctrine. Everyone thinks the resurrection is going to happen at the end of time, but we're going to tell them that our Messiah was raised in 3 days. Well, so far, if you're playing a game of baseball, you've got 3 strikes against you, right? Because these are not things that are going to promote your new religion, if that's what you're all about, and if it's a human movement that's going on. Darrell Bach, a New Testament scholar out of Dallas Theological Seminary, says, one could have defended Jesus and his future and his identity by simply saying, well, when the resurrection comes at the end of history, Jesus will run the judgment. He will be raised and exalted and run the judgment. In other words, this would have been the normal Jewish thinking. End of history, okay, then your Messiah raises up and he judges everyone. That makes more sense. But this whole 3-day thing, we don't quite follow that. You remember the story in John chapter 11 after Lazarus dies. And he's met by Mary and Martha as he's coming to Bethany. And Martha says, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. And Jesus says, your brother will rise again. And Martha says, I know, Lord. I know that he will rise again in the resurrection in the last day. Right? This is the Jewish belief. Jesus says to her, Martha, I am the resurrection and the life, and he who believes in me, though he were dead, yet shall he live. And of course, he proceeds to raise Lazarus. So we get a hint there of the normal Jewish doctrine of resurrection of the dead, last days. Nothing about, in their minds at least, not that the scriptures didn't teach it, but nothing in their minds that computed to this idea of someone being raised in the midst of history. The next evidence, number 4, has to do with beliefs by the Greco-Roman world about the resurrection. So there's a lot of hurdles for the early believers to overcome if they're preaching this message to fellow Jews. But when they get out into the wider Gentile world, there are even more problems that would confront their message. The first, obviously, is the shameful death of someone on a cross. But another one is that the Greeks and the Romans, they did not believe in a physical resurrection of the body. So, again, scholar Darrell Bach writes, the bulk of Greco-Roman hope has no resurrection in it. You either died and your body decomposed, and there was no hope whatsoever, or there was a belief in some type of immortality of the soul, a spiritual form of resurrection, but no physical dimensions to it whatsoever. And so Greco-Romans either had immortality of the soul or you died at death. So the resurrection would be a completely new concept, a problematic concept for a lot of the Greco-Romans. We have an inkling of this also over in Acts chapter 17. Remember the story where the Apostle Paul is in Athens and he's at the Areopagus in Athens and he's been telling them about the gospel. And in verse 32 of chapter 17, It says, when they heard about the resurrection of the dead, some of them sneered, but others said, we want to hear you again on this subject. That first part is the normal Greco-Roman reaction. Resurrection of the dead, you've got to be kidding. Maybe immortality of the soul, but certainly the body isn't going to rise again. So here's yet another hurdle that the early Christians would have to overcome. How much easier would it have been if the Christians had just conformed their message to the culture and to the beliefs around them? If their whole goal was to start a new religion and to get people on their side, you don't teach things that conflict with what everyone believes. You don't teach things that are scandalous and shameful. So why did they do it? Apparently because it was true. There's no other explanation. Another evidence for the truth of the resurrection has to do with women as witnesses. Each gospel testifies to the fact that women were the first to see Jesus alive and to proclaim the resurrection. Now, you might ask, what's unusual about that? Well, in our culture and society, there's nothing unusual and wrong about that. If a woman was credible and honest and she said something happened, you know, we'd believe her. In the ancient world, however, a woman's testimony was not considered credible. Sorry, ladies, you were born in the right century. It was a patriarchal world back then, and women weren't looked upon many times in the same way as they are today. Again, Daryl Bach says, it's very important to appreciate how crucial this idea is, because in the culture of the time, women could not be witnesses and weren't viewed as credible witnesses. Josephus, famous Jewish historian, writes in the Antiquities of the Jews, but let not the testimony of women be admitted on account of the levity and boldness of their sex. In the Jewish writings known as the Talmud, which is the compilation of the oral law, which wasn't done until a few centuries after Christ, but many of these teachings and beliefs go back to the first century. The Talmud says, any evidence that a woman gives is not valid. So what's the point of all this? Well, the point is that if you're making up a new religion and you want to say, yes, there was a resurrection and we have witnesses, and the very first witnesses to it are the women, oh boy, did you just make a big mistake or what? Talk about Peter being a witness. Talk about James or Paul being a witness. But don't bring the women into it, especially as being the very first witnesses. It destroys your credibility. So why did they do it? Why do all the Gospels record that the women were the first to see the resurrected Jesus? Because they were. Because it happened. It's true. There's no other explanation for it. Now, Daryl Bach has a really interesting comment regarding a few of these evidences that we're talking about here. He says, so, if you're in a PR meeting, and this is going to be the case that you're going to make, let's talk about a resurrection because Judaism expects a physical resurrection. Let's talk about a resurrection in the midst of history. That's a new idea and an unpopular one. Greco-Romans don't have it. And let's sell that idea by having our first witnesses be people who culturally don't count as witnesses. Bach concludes, you would never make up a story this way if it were made up. Okay? What's interesting about all of these evidences is that they're countercultural and they're counterintuitive. We look at man-made religions and they don't function like this. They look for ways to get people to agree with them and to get on their side. But just the opposite is happening here. Sorry, Jason, I messed you up. We need to go back a slide, don't we? I messed Jason up a lot in the first service, so I might as well do it a second time too. The last one that I want to talk about is what's known as the criterion of embarrassment. Now, what is that? The criterion of embarrassment is something that it's a standard that's used by historians to tell whether something is historical or not. How does that work? Well, for example, if you were inventing something, or if you were like making up something, like a new religion, what you would want to do is put all of the leaders of your movement in the best light possible. Their actions, their words, their character, you would want them to be seen as pristine examples of the type of thing that you're talking about. You certainly wouldn't want to tell stories about them that might discredit them. And yet the Gospels and Acts are full of stories about the blunders that Jesus' early disciples and apostles made. In Mark chapter 8, Jesus chides the disciples for their misunderstanding. In fact, throughout the Gospel of Mark, we constantly see the disciples being pictured as misunderstanding Jesus and misunderstanding what he says. In the Garden of Gethsemane, all of the Gospels record for us that the disciples fell asleep in Jesus' most critical hour. Their eyes were heavy. They fell asleep. They all forsook Jesus. The leader of them, Peter, even denied Jesus 3 times. Okay, on the one glorious occasion where Peter shines out, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God," and Jesus says, "Blessed are you, Simon Bar-Jonah, flesh and blood hasn't revealed this to you, but my Father in heaven." Then Jesus goes on to talk about his crucifixion and rising again on the 3rd day, and what does Peter do? He rebukes him. "Lord, this isn't going to happen to you." And Jesus says, "Get behind me, Satan." The leader of the 12, the guy who's going to preach that first sermon on Pentecost, where 3,000 are going to respond, and the Lord himself is saying, "Get behind me, Satan." These are not stories you want to let out if you're trying to gain credibility for your new religion. When the women come and proclaim the resurrection to the disciples, Luke 24, verses 9 through 11, Luke tells us not a one of them believed when the women first came and told them. These are not stories you invent if you're trying to prove your case for your new religion. So why are these stories told? Even the most skeptical historian will tell you, well, the reason they're told is they had to have happened because they don't really help the case of Christianity. There's no earthly reason to tell these stories unless they're true, unless they really happen. And so this criterion of embarrassment actually ends up being yet another way that reaffirms the authenticity of the stories about the cross and the resurrection. So let me summarize for you guys very quickly these 6 ideas that we've looked at. And honestly, there are others, but because of time constraints, I've focused on these 6 this morning. So if you take books like Lee Strobel's book and Josh McDowell's book, and you add to it these kinds of things, there is just a mountain of evidence for the resurrection. So number 1, we talked about honor and shame, the culture in which Christianity was birthed, and how people would seek to avoid shame at all costs. 2, the divine status accorded to Jesus by early Jewish worshipers who would refuse to worship anyone but God. 3, this idea of the resurrection on the 3rd day, which for Jews of the 1st century was a new concept. 4, just the physical bodily resurrection, which Greco-Romans didn't even believe in. 5, women as witnesses who weren't considered credible. And then 6, the criterion of embarrassment. Look at what goofballs we have for leaders. When you put all these things together, they're a powerful testimony that the resurrection is indeed the best explanation for the birth and the spread of Christianity. How else could it have been? How else could a religion like this have gotten off the ground when everything they did was countercultural and counterintuitive? In 1 Corinthians chapter 2, verses 2 through 5, Paul says, "For I resolved to know nothing while I was with you except Jesus Christ and him crucified." Now, against that background of honor and shame, think how powerful that statement is. "I resolved to know nothing among you except Jesus Christ and him crucified." I came to you in weakness with great fear and trembling. My message and my preaching were not with wise and persuasive words, but with a demonstration of the Spirit's power, so that your faith might not rest on human wisdom, but on God's power. This is the reason that Christianity not only survived the first century, why Christianity thrived, and why ultimately the cross of Christ defeated the most powerful empire of its time. It's the power of God. It's the only legitimate explanation for the survival of Christianity and for its thriving. Let me close again with 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 18, where Paul says, "For the message of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it is the power of God." Let's pray.